Sustainable Lens, Resilience on Radio. Hear an informed, intelligent and provocative discussion of sustainability issues every week. It's brought to you by Otago Polytechnic, where all students learn how to make their industries more sustainable. The regular panel of Samuel Mann and Shane Gallagher are joined every week by a leading figure in the sustainability scene, politics, science and controversy on Sustainable Lens on Radio, tonight at 7 o'clock, on podcast on www.sustainablelens.org or www.oar.org.nz.
Welcome to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. Tonight's guest is Dr. Andy Reid. Andy is the Stephen Toft Professor of Marine Biology at Duke University's Marine Lab. He is active in the conservation of marine vertebrates at the national and international levels. He has acted as a member of the Cetacean Specialist Group of the IUCN, the Scientific Committee of International Whaling Commission, the North Carolina Sea Turtle Advisory Committee, and several federal marine mammal take reduction teams. And from 2008 to 2010, he was president of the Society for Marine Mammalogy, the biennial conference of which he was a plenary speaker for in Dunedin. So, Andy, welcome to Dunedin.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And your talk today, your plenary talk today, was Conservation of Marine Mammals in the 21st Century, Challenges and Opportunities.
Right.
Well received?
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, it's always hard to ask the speaker whether you were well received or not, but I thought it went pretty well, yeah.
Is this a common theme of your research?
Yeah, I'm a conservation biologist who works with marine mammals, and I'm interested in developing new approaches to conservation and tackling difficult conservation problems and doing what we can as scientists to help implement those solutions in cases where we need to intervene. So, yeah.
A conservation biologist who works with marine mammals, is that the order of your...
Well, yeah, I think I was trained as a zoologist, you know, like a lot of people of my generation, and before there was formal training in conservation biology, and I kind of fell into conservation because a lot of the populations that I worked on were becoming endangered and threatened. So I kind of picked up my trade without much formal training, and I'm glad to see that the new generation of conservation biologists actually gets formal training in which we can impart to them all the errors we made along the way, and so that they don't have to go down that route. So, but I'd say in terms of the bulk of my work, yeah, I'm a conservation scientist. I'm interested in science that can be applied to minimize the loss of biodiversity, restore biodiversity. Most of my work is with marine mammals. I've done some work with sea turtles and some work with seabirds. Yeah,
sea turtles. Just writing down the things we need to come back to.
There you go.
And that's a Canadian accent, I hear, with something else underneath.
Yeah, it's Canadian with a bit of British and now a slight twang from eastern North Carolina, so it's a melange. Mm.
So you were born in England?
Born in Southampton and moved to North America when I was 10 or 11, and I've lived in Canada and the U.S., and now I live on the east coast of the U.S. in North Carolina, about halfway up. And, yeah, so I've moved around a lot, but, yeah.
And did you always want to be a zoologist?
I always wanted to be a marine biologist. I have to cop to Jacques Cousteau having a pretty profound influence on me when I was a young lad. And so, yeah, I always want. I loved being by the sea. We grew up by the sea, and I was very lucky. I didn't follow the advice of my elders, who told me there would be no work for somebody who wanted to do work in marine biology. And yeah, so I'm very happy I did that.
What was it that fascinated you as a youngster?
I loved being by the sea. It was the environment. But also, I think, trying to understand patterns and processes in an environment that you can't see like you can with a terrestrial ecosystem. And it just the mystery of that. And I think, actually, Cousteau opening up the world to viewers by filming underwater, this whole mysterious, beautiful, strange world that existed in three dimensions. And I found that fascinating and alluring, and I still do.
Were you a water baby?
No. No, terrible swimmer. Don't dive. Love being on boats. No.
So there's not a passion for actually being in the water?
No, not really. No. I like being on the water.
And you did your, in fact, all of your degrees at Guelph.
Yeah, University of Guelph in Ontario, which is one of the best universities in Canada. A great life science university, good veterinary school. And for a while, it was the hub of marine mammal research in Canada. It's no longer, but it was when I was a graduate student there. I kind of fell into working on marine mammals. I had a summer job in between university years. I applied for a job working on a fin whale skeleton at a museum. The museum had gone out to the east coast of Canada and found a stranded fin whale, brought it back, buried it north of Toronto, and needed somebody to come and dig it up and clean up the bones and get them ready for preparation. So I lied my way into the job, told them I knew a lot about whales, and I didn't, and then became fascinated with the animal that I was exhuming and cleaning and preparing, and became more broadly fascinated with whales and dolphins.
So you lied your way into a job.
Yeah.
Cleaning up a rotting whale.
Exactly. I always had an empty seat next to me on the subway in Toronto on the way home every night.
Did you know that you would find that fascinating? What was the passion in that?
Well, I knew I was interested in marine biology, and I just thought it was kind of a romantic idea to work on whales. I didn't realize the stench would be so bad, and the bits and pieces of doing that work would be so difficult. But I did love it. It was fun. Yeah.
But on the scale of romanticism and whales, cleaning up a rotting one isn't high on the agenda, I would have thought.
No, but you have your eye on the end product, which is a beautifully clean and articulated skeleton which still hangs in that museum that I helped put together. So, yeah.
Did you get it right when you put it together?
I believe largely so. It's tricky. It's tricky to actually – it's tricky physically to articulate them and to suspend them. It's also tricky – and there are a lot of misarticulated whale skeletons in the world. I think ours is mostly right.
Do you think the ones that are wrong should be fixed?
Yeah, absolutely. Because it's tricky to do it.
It's not like the dinosaurs where it's an interpretation anyway because
right.
We know what it should be like, presumably.
We do, although actually it's surprising. It's one of those things. There are very few anatomists in the world who – have taken apart whales properly. So most of our anatomy goes back to the 18th and 19th centuries, and a lot of that was not accurate. There are maybe two or three people in North America who can skillfully dissect a whale, one of whom is here in Dunedin at the conference right now. And you know, it's a difficult task. Your dissection tools include backhoes and large flensing knives, and it's an art, and to see somebody do it well so that you can understand how the animal was put together and then put the skeleton back together in the end is quite an art.
Is that science developing? Are we seeing people doing 3D models of whales and things, like the 3D human sort of thing? Is that being applied?
Yes, it is. And I think the traditional anatomical approaches are being supplemented and to some extent replaced by imaging, in which we can look at, you know, three-dimensional structure of soft and hard tissues. And there's some beautiful work, and there are quite a few people here at the meeting who have been leading that work, especially with respect to some of the really complex structures associated with the production of sound in the head of toothed whales, dolphins and porpoises, and sperm whales. We're still trying to understand how they produce such intense and useful sounds that they can use in navigation. It's a very complex and unique morphology in the head of those animals, and medical imaging techniques have proven to be very powerful in constructing and reconstructing those structures.
Presumably, you'd only get to do that with a dead one. You're not going to get a whale to lie still.
No, smaller animals. Dolphins actually have been trained to undergo MRI and CAT scans. And that's been actually – so there have been some experimental work in which animals are trained to vocalize while they're being imaged. And so we can actually see the structures producing sound moving in the heads of those animals. As I said, there are a unique set of structures that are not found in any other mammals. There's great interest in how those work and also interest in the effects of some anthropogenic factors like sound, naval sonars, seismic exploration on those structures in the head.
So is that what you did your PhD on the anatomy?
No, my PhD was looking at conservation bycatches of a particular small porpoise that's found in the Bay of Fundy in Canada. And I worked on the population biology of that animal. I was trying to understand whether the the animals, the number of animals that were being killed in a particular fishery, that whether that number was sustainable or not. So I developed population models using anatomical observations of the reproductive tracts of animals that I dissected that had been killed in fisheries. And then we did some experimental work to try and understand why these animals were being killed in these nets. And they have such a sophisticated echolocation system. You know, they're enormously well-equipped to navigate and detect objects in three dimensions underwater. So it's somewhat strange that they should become so frequently entangled and killed in nets that are set, static nets that are set on the seafloor.
You said that you're drawn to patterns and processes in environments you can't see.
Mm-hmm.
It must be tricky to do population demographics in populations you can't see.
Right. So the good thing is they all have to come up to the surface to breathe, and that's our chance to count them, identify them. And so with some animals, like the work that Liz and Steve have done with Hector's and Maui's dolphins, identifying individuals and following them through time is the best way to do that. And some other animals that are not as individually distinctive, we have other approaches that allow us to estimate how many animals are in a particular place at a particular time. But it is. It's a challenge. But it's an interesting challenge. So it makes it fun.
Of seeing 10 whales and knowing that that represents a particular 100 or something.
Yeah, that's part of the fun. I think the more fun is seeing 10 whales and recognizing that they're 10 whales you've seen before and you have a history of some of those whales going back 5, 10, 50, 20 years and being able to put together the life histories of those individuals over time and then using that information, how often they've had babies, when they die, when they mature, to create models that describe those patterns and processes over time. And then how both natural variation in systems in terms of prey abundance or seasonal or long-term environmental changes or human factors affect those processes. And that's kind of where most of my work is now, trying to understand how we as users of the ocean are affecting these populations and what we can do to minimize those adverse effects.
And those populations are over vast areas. Some of these whales move a lot, don't they?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so we have been working in the Antarctic, for example, along the western Antarctic Peninsula, which reaches up towards the tip of South America. And we've been working with humpback and minke whales down there, putting satellite-linked transmitters on those animals. And the humpback whales that we study down there migrate all the way from the Antarctic to the Gulf of Panama, pretty much straight line. So it's remarkable, you know, how directional the movement is, but also the vast areas that constitute the home ranges of those animals. When we think about, you know, you think about how far most terrestrial mammals range over, and then the scales at which these whales and dolphins move is much larger. So their perception of their environment is very different. You know, they think that those whales are anywhere are operating at the level of ocean basins, which is pretty remarkable.
And why do they move around so much?
Good question. So they utilize the Antarctic because of the plentiful prey there. So they feed on Antarctic krill, like most of the predators in the Antarctic system. And for reasons that are still unclear, you would think that we would have sorted this out by now, being clever scientists. But for reasons that are still unclear, many large whales move to the tropics to breed. The best hypothesis that we have now is that the risk of predation to the young whales, to the baby whales, the calves, when they're born from killer whales is lower in the tropics. And so it's advantageous to the adult females to go to those areas to give birth. And there's a considerable energetic cost of making those movements, not so much in the travel because whales are constantly moving and if they decide to go in one direction, they can go a long way. But in terms of the thermoregulation, so if you think about a whale that's been feeding all summer in the Antarctic, getting fatter and fatter, storing up energy for the rest of the year when it's going to fast, that animal wearing that big, thick blubber coat then has to swim all the way to very warm waters of the tropics and somehow keep cool enough while it's in those tropical waters and then give birth and nurse its calf and then swim back. So we think that the energetic costs of keeping cool in those waters is pretty substantial. So there has to be a pretty good benefit in terms – some selective benefit to the animals to do that. And our best bet now is that it's lower risk of predation.
Do the males migrate as well?
Because the girls are there. The males follow the girls.
Couldn't they do the business in the Antarctic?
Well, there some of the business is done on the way, but most of the seasonality of reproduction in the females is such that it occurs in the tropics, and that's just the timing of gestation. Pregnancy for most large whales takes about a year, and so that means that a female that's going to give birth next year is going to be cycling, going into oestrus a year earlier, and should be in the tropics at that time. That's the dogma. We think, actually, that probably more animals than we suspected are staying in the Antarctic in the wintertime. We're not down there. We've worked very late into the fall and early into the winter, but it's not possible to do the kind of work we would need to do in the dead of the winter just because the conditions are so bad down there.
How many times have you been down?
Three times recently, yeah. We just started a program. We're part of a long-term ecological research program known as the Palmer LTER, where we work with colleagues who are studying penguins and trying to understand the physical processes that affect krill populations. And it's a really interesting place because it's one of the places in the planet that is warming the quickest. And so we can really see effects of climate change on the physical environment there and the consequent effects on the ecology of upper trophic level predators like penguins and whales. Essentially, we're seeing a migration of a long-term movement of sub-Antarctic species into what used to be Antarctic waters. So Adelie penguins are being replaced by Gentoo penguins, which are a subpolar species. And so as that area warms, there's an invasion of these subpolar species that are outcompeting the pagophilic, the ice-loving species. So it's I think we feel climate change the most keenly at the poles, and that's one of the places that we can really understand over shorter time periods, over decadal time periods anyway, some of the ecological effects of that change.
Enough that we should be worried about that particular effect?
I think very much. Yeah, I think we're concerned about that particular ecosystem because we care about penguins and whales. But I think that's a signal of what's coming in other places. I think that there, at least, it's a very strong environmental signal, and so we can understand that in relation to the background variation in climate down there. I think in other places it'll be trickier to sort out that signal because the signal's not so strong. But yeah, I think we need to be very concerned about it. It's going to change. Change will be good for some species and bad for other species, and we'll just have to see how it sorts out.
One of my interests in this huge home range is the complexity that brings to managing those ecosystems.
Mm-hmm.
Is it possible to manage the entire range of a whale, or is it we try and have a management bit for where they are here and these bits in the middle and these bits over here?
It's a good question. So for example, the humpback whales that we tagged in the Antarctic, they're in waters that are not universally claimed by any country, so they're in international waters. Then they migrate through the waters of Chile, through Peru, through Ecuador, Colombia, and into Panama. So they're moving through the exclusive economic zones of many countries that have differing levels of protection, differing threats in terms of entanglement of fishing gear, ship strikes. Panama's been very proactive recently in changing shipping lanes to minimize the potential for ship strikes with the whales that we study in the Antarctic. So I think it's very difficult to manage at the level at which one would want to if one were to try and match the ecological scales at which those animals work. So that kind of brings in the idea of the International Whaling Commission trying to manage whales. They were set up to manage the harvest of whales, and they have attempted to intervene in management, other aspects of the management of whales, things like ship strikes and environmental change. But it's obviously not a very effective management body. So, yeah. So I think the short answer to your question is no, it would be useful to do that, but generally it's impossible to do that.
Is there any chance of changing the name of the Whaling Commission?
Taking
off the
whaling. So that gets to the debate at the heart of the IWC. So I've served on the scientific committee of the IWC for a long time. It's a very discouraging process. I think there's no chance of doing that because it would require a two-thirds majority vote to do that, and I think that that's not going to happen. You know, so I think we're stuck in this impasse, and that impasse is going to go on. Although I would say that the decision at the International Court of Justice, the case with Australia and Japan, could be very telling, and we're all kind of looking forward to seeing what the court says.
Is the fate of the whales? It's probably too hard to generalize, but is it getting better or worse?
I would say, yeah, if you were to generalize, you would say it has been getting much better. So many populations of whales are recovering from past overharvest. There are protective measures in place in most countries. And even at the International Whaling Commission, as dysfunctional as it is, many species of whales are completely protected. And so we're seeing populations of whales like humpback whales, sperm whales, blue whales in many areas recover and starting to recolonize areas from which they've been extirpated. And that's a really encouraging sign. One of our students is involved in a project in Alaska where humpback whales are viewed as somewhat as pests because they are consuming salmon smolts that are being released as part of a conservation project to try and enhance salmon runs in some of the streams in Alaska. And some whales have learned to sit and wait for the release of those young salmon and consume them when they're released. So, I think the fact that many of those populations are recovering is a sign that even in kind of laissez-faire conservation with some of those populations, we're seeing very positive signs. Now, that's not to say that all populations are recovering, but if you had to generalize, I think you would say that the conservation status of whales is much better now than it was 50 years or 100 years ago. That's a good thing.
Is there a pattern in the ones that are not doing so well? Is it we've talked to Barbara
and Jay
and Jay particularly about the vaquita, and relating that to the to the hectares,
right,
which seem to be very sort of similar in size, if nothing else.
Right. Size and environment,
Is it those sort of river harbor dolphins that are in trouble?
Yes, I would say that's for sure. So small-bodied species that live in riverine environments or coastal environments that are highly modified by human activity are the ones that we're most concerned about. I would say river dolphins in particular. So there are many riverine systems in Asia in which dolphins are present but extremely threatened from a variety of causes. And those are really critical conservation cases, as are some of the other smaller-bodied dolphins that are taken as bycatch in fisheries, like Hector's and Maui's dolphins, like the vaquita, and there are a couple of others as well. So in general, the bigger-bodied whales are doing better. But in some of those species that were over-harvested, like right whales in the North Pacific and the North Atlantic, some of those populations have not recovered because there were illegal harvests by the Soviets several decades ago, many decades ago now. And some are still threatened by entanglement of fishing gear and ship strikes. And so that's the reason for their lack of recovery. But in general, if you wanted to generalize, you would say that the small-bodied species of whales and dolphins and porpoises that live in rivers and in coastal environments that are heavily modified by human activities, so those are the ones we're really worried about. And there's a pretty good list of them.
So the threats used to be that we were fishing, that we were catching them and eating them.
Exactly.
Using turning them to oil. But now it's a whole complex of different issues.
Right, and that's the tricky part, I think, as we look forward, and that's what I talked about today a bit. I talked about wicked problems that are complex, difficult to characterize, problems when you don't know how to intervene, or if you do intervene, you don't know whether you're being successful or not. And we have lots of those. Some of the examples I gave, one of the examples I gave was river dolphin that lives in the Mekong River in Cambodia. Much reduced in size. We think there are only about 80 animals left. The population was greatly reduced during the Khmer Rouge era in Cambodia when they were shot for oil and food. So they're really restricted to a very small part of the Mekong River now, downstream from Laos. And they're threatened by a whole number of human activities, including illegal electrofishing, some bycatch in nets. The big threat coming is hydroelectric development on the river. There are five dams that are proposed, have been proposed in the range of the species, and 10 or 15 dams upstream in China and Laos. So it's difficult. I mean, I use that as an example of a very wicked problem, a conservation problem. We're concerned about the viability of these dolphins. But when you think about what problems we need to solve food security for 60 million people who depend on the Mekong River. And those 60 million people are mostly desperately poor, want to have their standard of living increased. They want power so that they can have power to their schools and their refrigerators, as they should. So how do we balance those needs and the thoughts about social justice with the ecological needs of 80 animals in that river? And that those are the tricky conservation problems that keep you up at night.
Do you have any answers?
No. And I said that today. I said, you know, those truly wicked problems are ones that don't have answers. If they did, they wouldn't be wicked. And I think the approach is to engage with the stakeholders there. You can't engage with 60 million people, but you can engage with representatives of people who depend on the river. And that's been done to a large extent in Cambodia. There's a very effective program there that's been led by WWF Cambodia that has engaged with government agencies and other NGOs and villagers living along the river. And so it's a dialogue to have with those people. The people in Laos and Cambodia believe that river dolphins are sacred. There's a national commission for dolphin conservation and ecotourism. There's a small but thriving ecotourism industry in which tourists actually go to some pretty remote places in Cambodia to see these dolphins. So there's the potential there, but when you balance that against all the other things that are going to happen in the Mekong, it's tough. It's tricky. But I think a couple of things we can do. We can engage with those communities. We can have a dialogue. We can try and find win-win solutions. The ecotourism one is part of that. But, ecotourism is not going to support 60 million people. And think about smart ways to harvest fish that are going to be sustainable both for fisheries and dolphins. The hydroelectric issue is one that's very troubling because those are larger economic forces at play there that that are harder to engage with.
And again, it crosses political boundaries.
Absolutely. So there's a Mekong River Commission that involves Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, and China, I think. So, very large economic forces and big profits and a big need for power.
Does the International Whaling Commission have interest in those sorts of river dolphins as well?
They do, although it's complicated. So when the commission was set up, the commission was established to manage the harvest of the great whales. And there, in the convention itself, there is a list of the whale species that the convention applies to. So all the signatories of the convention, the member countries of the IWC, have agreed that they will manage that group of whales. And that's really all the large whales. The smaller whales, the dolphins and porpoises, are generally agreed to lie outside the competency of the IWC, the International Whaling Commission. But the commission has a scientific committee on which I and Jay and Barb and Liz and Steve have all served. And the scientific committee provides advice to member countries about the status, the conservation status of those smaller cetaceans. Not all member countries agree that it is within the remit of the IWC to provide scientific advice. Some countries, particularly Japan, believes that the IWC should not be engaged in any discussions on small cetaceans. But the majority of countries that comprise the IWC believe it's okay to provide advice regarding conservation status, but not management. So we walk a very fine tightrope at the IWC. I used to chair the Small Cetacean Subcommittee, whereas we could make a statement such that we are concerned about the viability of the population of river dolphins in the Mekong River in Cambodia, and that if current removals are not curtailed, that population is not likely to be sustained over the long term. It would not be appropriate for us, given the politics of the IWC, to say, so, given that, this management measure should be implemented by the government of Cambodia. The government of Cambodia is a member of the IWC, but because the river dolphin in the Mekong River was not listed in the convention. None of the governments believe that the IWC should be providing management advice regarding those small animals. It sounds arcane, and it is arcane, but it's important in international whale politics.
So if you're making those the first half of that statement, who's making the second half?
NGOs, right? So we work very closely, kind of hand in hand with NGOs to make sure that the advice that we give to member countries and to the international community at large is useful and practical. And so those NGOs, like WWF Cambodia, then can work with governments and other stakeholders to try and implement change, effect change. So it's a delicate dance, but it can be a pretty effective one. It's same thing is true of the vaquita in Mexico, and the same thing is true with Hector's and Maui's dolphins, in which the IWC Scientific Committee has provided advice regarding the status of those animals, but not has never told the government of New Zealand what it should do. Nor should it, probably.
Is there a is there a general solution for wicked problems? But as you pointed out, then they wouldn't be wicked.
No, there is not. Problems.
But is there an approach to solving, to engaging people? Or perhaps that's the answer. Is it about engaging
people? It is. I think that's it. That's as far as we can get. It's about engaging people, beginning a dialogue, trying to find, if not solutions, then strategies that benefit human communities and are as least damaging as possible to the environment. And one of the characteristics of wicked problems is there are no solutions. There are just good or bad options. So it's a matter of engaging in that dialogue, trying to find the best options, and not being afraid to take innovative approaches and to try things. I think one of the things that the conservation community has been guilty of is being a bit timid sometimes and being afraid to experiment with conservation approaches because we're afraid they may fail. Inaction is failure as well. So we shouldn't be shy about trying things.
Even if that, I suppose that's, if that inaction is brought about by the political structures that we have, which means that nothing gets done.
Right.
You would see that as failure?
Yeah, I would. I think, well, the failure, the proof will be in the pudding, right? If you lose a population or you lose a species like we did with the Baiji, the river dolphin, and Yangtze, that was essentially political inaction. The conservation community really couldn't decide, including the scientific community, couldn't decide how best to intervene in China. There was one school of thought that suggested that the remaining animals in the Yangtze River should be captured and brought into captivity because there was no chance that they would be able to survive in the wild. Other folks argued that that was not a good approach because at least in the foreseeable future, there'd be nowhere to put them back into. And so we had a kind of back and forth dialogue. But in general, we were afraid. I think the conservation community was afraid of action and we did nothing and the species went extinct. And that was a big loss because it was a large mammal species that went extinct. It was the only species in its genus and the only species in its family. So we lost an entire family of mammals, and that doesn't happen very often. They were a very unusual dolphin, and it's been a great loss to have seen them blink out.
In terms of engaging people, what are the things that we can do to engage not just the politicians but the wider population?
Well, you're doing one of them here, right? So I think getting people to think about consequences of our everyday actions, where we buy a fish, how we use our boats, what we do in terms of runoff of pollutants into coastal waters, how we develop our coastal environments, all those things we do have consequences for the sustainability of marine systems. And I think the more we can get people to think about how each of us each of our actions impacts those systems, the better we'll be. I think a lot of times we don't think about that very much.
We're not very good at it, are we?
No, we're not. And I think we've evolved to not be deliberately not good at that, right? Our brains are structured so that we focus on things that have direct selective advantage to us. You know, where's the next predator coming or where's the next mate coming from? You don't think about, oh, yeah, I have to talk down to the supermarket to get my crumpets and, you know, so. So I think I agree with you. We don't do a very good job of that.
I've been working today on developing a survey of incoming computing students, trying to get some understanding of their sort of naive, their ethics, their ethical worldview. And it's pretty apparent that we're really struggling with that as a general rule. Do you find that people that choose zoology as a career move into that more quickly? You probably haven't had experience of teaching computing people, but we struggle in computing.
Right.
But I'm imagining that if somebody is wanting to be a zoologist, then they already care for whales, whatever it might be.
Yeah, I think that's true, right? People are attracted to the field because they love animals or they love natural environments. And I think that love makes people want to protect them and make the systems viable. I mean, I one of the reasons I do what I do is, you know, I love spending days on the water surrounded by the animals that I like to study, and I want those systems to be there for generations to come. So, yeah.
Why?
I think that I would invoke kind of E.O. Wilson here and say that humans do have an innate love of natural complexity. You know, we look at some of the beautiful environments here in New Zealand. I was flying down here from Auckland, and I was just, you know, you can't help but be struck by how spectacular that is. And what does that mean? Why would we think that's spectacular? I mean, it's complicated, it's rugged, but why do we think that's beautiful? We all agree that it's beautiful. So I think there's something innate in us that appreciates that. There's something very central to being human that most of us appreciate. And I don't know that we understand exactly why that is, but I think we do appreciate that complexity of the natural world. And as we simplify the world as a result of careless actions, I think the world becomes a less beautiful and a less precious place to us.
The things that were described as charismatic megafauna have got a better chance,
right.
And we certainly use them as sort of poster children to
we do
hopefully bring along the rest of the species. Other ugly whales that have got less of a chance?
No, but within marine mammals, I think there's definitely a dichotomy between the way we view whales from the way we view seals and sea lions. I think people tend to love whales more than they love seals and sea lions. And so I think that we do, you know, it's all about value systems, right? And charismatic megafauna are valued because of some reason we love whales, and we don't love slugs as much as we do whales. But yeah, so there's always a gradation. And you're right, we in some guilty fashion do use these as flagship or umbrella species to try and conserve entire ecosystems as well. So the Mekong River dolphin is a good example. That dolphin needs hydrological complexity. It needs prey populations that are intact. It needs a viable environment within which to live, and that environment is also important for all those people who depend on the river for food.
And it's probably a good example in that there probably aren't obvious technological solutions to it.
Right.
In so many of the sustainability issues, people think that there is a technology solution. Somebody is going to invent the new fuel or whatever it might be, so it doesn't matter how much coal I burn.
Right.
But I don't think there is this one's hiding from me. I don't think that there is something in that complex system.
No, and I agree. And I think that's part of the wickedness of the problem, right? If there was, and people always search for the technological fix. There's got to be a silver bullet there somewhere. But in those issues that involve complex patterns of human behavior and humans that are motivated by different ideas and different reasons, it's really difficult to try and find a technological solution that's going to solve anything, because those problems are so complicated in the first place. You need to solve food security. You need to solve the demand for power. And in doing so, you need to make sure that there are still dolphins in that system. I don't see a technological fix for that. It's really about finding ways to coexist. And that's complex and subtle ways of changing and modifying human behavior to reduce our footprint.
No,
which is very hard, I would say, which is very hard if you're a poor Cambodian who lives without power and worries about how to feed your kids.
And there's not an obvious payback.
No, although, again, in that system, because people have a very high regard for those animals, from a spiritual perspective. And because there is some economic benefit in terms of tourism coming there, there's some positive aspects to that. But, yeah, it's a bit of an uphill climb.
Now, I'm not going to get forgiven if I don't ask about turtles. Because I live with someone that's got turtles all over the house. Tell me about turtles.
Well, turtles are interesting for lots of reasons. I came into turtles after I got involved in marine mammal conservation, and some of the same issues, bycatch and fisheries, but other interesting flavors of conservation problems because they're reptiles, because they're cold-blooded, because the sex of baby turtles is determined by the temperature in the nest. And as we see climate change now, we're starting to see changes in the sex ratios produced in some areas. And, of course, because many turtles forage in nearshore systems that are being degraded, we're worried about habitat loss and we're worried about interactions with fishing gear and boats. So some of the same categories of issues that we have with marine mammals, slightly different flavors. They're great animals to work with. They're interesting. They're very different. Usually the people who love turtles are not the same people as the people who love whales.
And people still eat them.
They do, yeah. Lots of places there are people still eat whales in lots of places too, but probably more people eat turtles. And I think one of the things I talked about today was dealing with conservation success stories. And as some of these populations recover, and for example, green turtles in Hawaii is a really good example. Those populations now are really not endangered. They're currently protected by the U.S. Endangered Species Act, which is a very powerful piece of legislation. But I think managers are starting now that the science is clear that that population of turtles is no longer endangered, should really be taken off the Endangered Species Act list. How are we going to manage them? And there are Native Hawaiians who would like to resume their traditional cultural practices of consuming turtles. And so I think we should accommodate that. And how we go about doing that and what kind of management structure we put into place to deal with that kind of sustainable harvest, it's going to be tricky. But I think especially with Aboriginal subsistence harvest, we shouldn't shy away from that. The consumption of turtles has been very important to many Aboriginal peoples. And if we can do it sustainably, I don't see why we shouldn't do it.
Is that something which we could contemplate for other things like the whales?
Yeah, for sure. And there are sustainable Aboriginal harvests of whales now, bowhead whales in Alaska, really well-managed fishery, a harvest of whales in which the U.S. Federal government and the Alaskan Eskimo Whaling Commission co-manage the harvest in addition to the International Whaling Commission. The population is recovering from past commercial over-harvest, even as the subsistence needs of Alaskan Native peoples are being met. So I think that's a really good case in which we can combine the conservation of a species to make sure the bowhead whale recovers with the Aboriginal cultural subsistence needs of people who live on the North Shore of Alaska. One of the interesting things that we talked about at the end of today's session was how we can also interject issues of animal welfare into those Aboriginal subsistence harvests. Can we help Aboriginal peoples to harvest animals more sustainably? And so the Alaskan Eskimo hunters actually have gone a long way to try and work with animal welfare scientists to try and minimize the negative animal welfare aspects of their hunt, making their hunts as humane as possible. So in addition to a conservation success story, I think that's a situation in which the hunters are working to try and adopt modern practices that make their hunts more humane. It's a really interesting case. So, yeah, long answer to your question, I don't see any reason why Aboriginal peoples who have evolved a culture of dependence on, respect for, and consumption of marine mammals or turtles or any marine fauna shouldn't continue to do that. There are cases, though, in which those Aboriginal harvests have become unsustainable. And in those cases, I think we clearly need conservation intervention, both from the side of biodiversity conservation and also to make sure that there's a resource there for those people to harvest in the future.
Does it matter if they're doing that fishing from an aluminum boat?
It's an interesting question, right? Should you go back to using traditional practices. And there's a tension there between how well and how humanely you can kill animals. I think that's a very difficult issue. I think from a personal perspective, I would like to see a minimization of suffering. And if that means that Aboriginal harvests and Aboriginal hunters incorporate modern techniques into their harvest, then that's fine by me.
It's a I'm thinking about the conflict in my own head as someone that's grew up as a child wearing Save the Whale
right.
badges, as mm-hmm. everyone did in the 70s and 80s and mm-hmm. perhaps on, and the thought that people are killing them for food.
Right.
But it's, I don't suppose it's unique. We still love calves.
Right. Lambs.
But happily eat that. We're pretty good at putting those in separate boxes.
Yeah. We are, and it's about values, right? And so we have a set of values that differs from the set of values that a hunter in Barrow, Alaska has. To that hunter, the whale is food for the year. It's also an important cultural resource. It's a status resource. And I think so we need to be mindful of cultural differences when we think about those boxes in our heads. And you and I have a pretty common set of value systems, I would guess, in which we would not think that harvesting whales for food was something we would want to do. But to somebody who's grown up in a culture that has engaged in that practice sustainably for thousands of years, I think it's not appropriate for us to tell them that that's a wrong thing to do.
The Japanese factory ships in the Southern Ocean, it's hard. It's a hard argument to say that that's traditional.
Exactly. And I would argue that for those harvests, we should be able to move beyond that. And those are clearly not culturally or nutritionally subsistence harvests. That's an industrial harvest. And I would make the case that we have moved past the need to harvest whales at an industrial scale. We didn't do it very well for the 100 years or so when we did it. It had terrible consequences. And my personal view would be that I would be very reticent to trust any industrial scale whaling to act in a sustainable fashion. I think it's unlikely to happen. I don't think we should do it.
When you go down to Antarctica looking at whales, mm-hmm. do you have a big sign on the side of your ship that says, research, no, really?
No, we're fortunate, and the part of Antarctica that we work in is a part that the Japanese special permit catches doesn't occur. So we don't occupy the same space and time that they do. We're in the place where we work. There's an enormous amount of ecotourism, and in fact, that's one of the things we're slightly concerned about is the effect of ecotourism on whales down there because it's largely unregulated. It's not the kind of place where people go to harpoon whales.
What about the people that are taking more direct action?
Interesting. So I think it's not the course of action that I think is appropriate or necessarily a wise course of action, but I always think of these conflicts in terms of a continuum. So on one side you have kind of hardliners who promote the harvest, the industrial scale harvest of whales. In the middle, you have people that are concerned about sustainability and to some extent animal welfare issues. And on the other end, you have the direct action people, and those people are perhaps necessary to provide a balance. Although I would say I don't condone their methods, especially this. I think the Sea Shepherd folks. I don't think that they're helping the debate.
They're getting it onto the world's media, though.
They have, and that's the thing you can't argue with, right? That the fact that their actions have elevated the debate in terms of the number of people who are engaged in the debate. But I think their methods are not appropriate.
At the other end of the scale, what about the whales in captivity in the marine park?
Right, we're gonna have a discussion about that later this week at the meeting. I think it's a really difficult issue. I teach a class in the biology of marine mammals at Duke University, and my final exam for my class was to watch the movie Blackfish and tell my students they thought it was ethically appropriate to keep killer whales in captivity or not. So I'll let you know when I read their papers.
What do you think?
I thought you might ask that. I think killer whales, I think it's a hard sell to say that it's appropriate to keep those animals in captivity. They're very long-lived, highly social animals. Killer whales can live for 80, maybe 100 years. They live in groups that are permanent. Animals never leave their natal groups. It's hard for me to see how it's appropriate to keep animals like that in captivity. I would make the same argument about elephants as well.
You don't think that you would be taking direct action, but do you consider yourself to be an activist?
I consider myself to be a conservation scientist and not an activist now. I try and provide science so that we can have an informed debate about conservation actions. And it's a very difficult line to walk, right? So I have my – we've talked about some of my personal opinions here. And when I go into a debate, I try and make sure that it's clear my science side and then my personal view side. And trying to keep those separate sometimes is tricky.
And you've got a big organic garden, it says here on your website.
I do, and chickens. So, yeah, I mean, yes, I do. Yeah. One thing I will say, I mean, conservation is a normative discipline, right? We believe that the loss of biodiversity is a bad thing and that we should do everything we can to minimize that loss of biodiversity caused by human activities and to restore it when we can. And so in that way, I feel, yes, I'm an activist, but I think all people working in conservation are activists. It's a normative discipline, and we accept that part of our science, whereas other folks in different disciplines hew supposedly to a more objective stance.
And what challenges have you got for the next couple of years?
Working within a dysfunctional American government that likes to shut down and cut funding for research and science. But I would say the challenges that we have ahead of us are many small populations that are at risk of extinction, trying to find ways to keep those populations going in environments that are increasingly impacted by human activities. Yeah.
And if there's one thing that our listeners should do as a taking action, you got any suggestions as to what would you like them to do?
Think about where your seafood comes from. Think about how your activities affect the coastal environments, the beautiful coastal environments here in New Zealand and elsewhere. You know, all of our actions have impacts, and we should all be trying to minimize those impacts and make our footprint on the planet as small as we can. And there are ways to do that, especially thinking about where our food comes from. That's maybe one of the easiest things we can do.
Thank you very much for joining me today. It's been fabulous.
It's been my pleasure.
Sustainable Lens on Radio.
You've been listening to Sustainable Lens Resilience on Radio, a weekly show on sustainability topics brought to you by Otago Polytechnic. The show is co-hosted by Shane Gallagher and me, Samuel Mann. Tonight's guest was Dr. Andy Reid, part of our Whale of a Summer series. We broadcast on Otago Access Radio, oar.org.nz, and podcast on sustainablelens.org. Follow the links there to find us on Facebook, to keep in touch and find details and sneak previews of upcoming guests. You can listen to Sustainable Lens via iTunes as well. That was Sustainable Lens. I'm Samuel Mann, and I hope you enjoyed the show.